KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
I'm a paleo nut, I'm a paleo nut, don't you understand? I'm a paleo
nut. Hey, Ray!
Hello, David!
How's it going, man?
That's going. It's been so long since we've done this. You went away. You were gone.
It's only been a month, dude. Only been a month. Yeah, I was in, I went down under.
Down under?
And I did 25 performances in 30 days, traveling 3,700 kilometers, which equates to 2,229 miles.
2,000 miles of with Dave and crew, right?
My tour manager and my stage technician travel in the SUV, while my lighting designer and production manager, sound guy, travels in the 6-ton truck.
Oh, whoa. And you're in the limo out front?
The limo. Try SUV.
So, man, you're back on tour. How did it feel?
It was great. I mean, people are, oh, boy, that must be hard. 2 shows a night. We sold out almost every show. Oh, that must be so hard. And it isn't. I perform puppets for a living. I make people laugh. I'm blessed to do this. You know, sitting in an office all day long is hard. Being on a construction site is hard. Geez, fixing the roads in the hot summer is hard, so I'm just blessed.
Yeah, I know you have tough, you know, those hotels you have to stay in, all the fans surrounding you, the good food, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
The applause, the love that you feel every night, you know. That's got to be good. No, I mean, really, enjoy it, you know.
Oh, yeah, I do enjoy it, and I'm very fortunate and blessed. And I also gave back to the community. I visited some children's hospitals, so that was great. It was good, so I'm back home now for the summer, and then I'm on a privately funded fossil dig in Montana, where they
privately
said
funded.
Hmm. Yeah. So, well, you could actually go to a museum and pay for these things.
So, if you pay for it, you get to maybe tag along, or if you help pay for it.
No. What I'm saying is, if anybody wants to go, most museums have a thing where you can go out and you pay to fossil.
Right. It's your free work. Your free labor. So here's a shovel. Dig like
this. So
this
is a privately funded dig that I'm going on.
Cool. What are you digging for, man?
Well, they said that there is possibly a juvenile Tyrannosaurus in the Hell Creek Formation.
What?
Yeah, a Triceratops frill and a turtle the size of a truck tire.
A land turtle or must be.
Well, this is just after the KPG boundary, so it's very...
Now, wait.
Early. No. Huh?
It's after the KPG, so what do you do with dinosaurs? Yes. That doesn't make sense, Dave.
Okay. The boundary is right there where I'm going.
Okay.
It's literally right there.
You could go on either side of it, is what
you're
saying.
You can go on either side and be sans dinosaurs or with dinosaurs.
So you're in the Cretaceous over here and in the Paleocene over there.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay, right, I got it.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So you're going to get the Triceratops. You know, it would be astounding news if you found a Triceratops on the other side over there in the Paleogene.
Yeah.
You know, we would read about that one. But
yeah, I don't
think
it's going to happen. Yeah. So that's me and my son are going to do that and really looking for big sky country, crazy weather.
What museum is doing this? What museum?
Oh, Museum of the Rockies out of Bozeman, Montana.
And who's your hosts there?
They are fantastic paleontologists, John Scanella and Lee Hall.
Oh,
who is partner to Ashley Hall, who we've interviewed on Paleo Nerds.
Ah, excellent, man. That's cool. Well, take your sunscreen and take your sun,
yeah,
so to speak. Yeah. See what I did there? So that's cool. So you're going to be out there in the site for a while?
Well, just a week, so that'll be great.
Well, maybe
they
find
something.
I've
never really
done
that. You know, I've gone fossicking all over, but I've never been on an actual dig that these guys have been doing it for decades and...
Oh, really? So you never have? Okay.
Oh, no. Never done an actual dig, you know, from an institution. No.
You use the word fossicking, dude. So that's a down under term.
Yeah, fossicking means to look for stuff.
Yeah, to Fossil Barone.
And have you been on a? Have you been on? You've been on digs.
I've been on digs. Yeah, I've been on several digs in my life now.
Oh, that's right. You went to the as the a middle-aged man. River.
I went to the Colville River. I went on an ammonite hunt in 1998 with our guest today. And he introduced me to the world of
digs. Our guest today?
Yeah. So we have a guest.
Oh, my goodness. That's right. We're interviewing.
Yeah, we're back to that. But I wanted to talk about what I'm doing. Enough about you, Dave.
Okay.
At least act interested, man.
Okay.
All right.
Well, no, you're naming your digs. I want to go back. Colville River. You went. So, where was the ammonites?
Ammonites in Kremlin, Colorado, and visited various sites. And went to Dinopalooza in Wyoming, and that was
a party concert.
It was a party concert kind of thing, yeah. And found ichthyosaurs with Dr. Johnson. We up in Wyoming somewhere. I forget, but yeah, I've been to various
That's
digs.
Great. And I've been on, of course, I've been on some very private digs with you. We haven't really dug. We just observed and really never collected much. But that's been really the basis for Paleo Nerds, was me going out to some of these places in Alaska and you telling me all about it and me asking questions. And that's how this podcast came about.
That's right. I thought this was fossil deprived up here, but it turns out, you know, fossils are everywhere, man.
Yeah.
Kind of a theme. But hey, I just want to tell you, I have a three-legged bear in my yard. So not everybody has that.
Yeah, it's so sad. I saw the video, and it looks just like his left front paw was removed by a steel trap. That's what it looks like.
Yes, I think like the whole lower arm there was removed by a trap. I believe.
But he gets around fine, according to the video that you sent me.
Well, yeah. What's been interesting? I posted this. It's getting all kinds of attention. This is from a game camera that my neighbor put out, pointing at my yard because there's been bear shit all over the place. Can I say that? Bear crap. No. Bear crap all over the yard. So we knew that something was going on. My neighbor put a game camera out. And we have several videos now of, I'm calling him Hobbles.
Yeah, that's original.
Yeah. Well, you know, there were the obvious ones like Eileen.
Peg.
Or Stumpy or Tripod or, yeah, Peg. But anyways, it turns out that old Hobbles has been all over the neighborhood and actually for years now. So there's a lot of other videos of him here in
Does anybody know the nature of his foot? No.
No. It looks like it might have happened when he was but a youngster and it's well healed and he gets around. But yeah, trapping, man. I don't know.
That's so sad. No. Yeah. I'm just so over the idea of any kind of hunting. And even though fishing, you know, I mean, I still do love fishing, but even that as an older man,
yes,
I'm just not sensitive guys. Killing anything. Yeah, we're sensitive. I am. I don't know about you.
Nah, pretty hardened. I'm Alaskan, man. But hey, segueing to our guest, should we talk about our guest? You want to do that?
Well, we're going to be talking to him for probably an hour or more. And one thing I love about this guest, I've probably spent more time with him than any of the other guests that we've ever had on Paleo Nerds. It's been 55 episodes since we had our first guest, Dr. Kirk Johnson, on this show. So what a great way to bring him back and see what's been happening in between.
And he's been listening to all of our shows. We'll see.
No. Oh, where's the critique?
Well, let's see what he has to say. If he wants to say anything, we won't tease it out. Maybe it'll just happen naturally.
And tell me again, what does he do again? He works at the local Quick Stop down the street? Or what is the other job he does?
Well, he's a paleobotanist by training, so he studies prehistoric plants. But he is the director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History.
What, the Smithsonian?
Yeah.
The one?
You mean the biggest
the one
natural
with
history?
Pictures of him and David Attenborough, like having fun in his office? That guy?
Yeah, that guy, looking at a piece of art that you own, by the way. So thank you very much at that ammonite drawing.
Well, we'll have that on the website, the picture. I have that photo of you and Kirk dancing to that picture that you drew, and also him and David Attenborough at the same picture.
Yeah, so let's nerd out with our buddy Kirk, shall we? Let's call him up on the old, you know, paleo phone. Hey, Dave, welcome back. Kirk Johnson, director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. Kirk, what up, man?
Hey, Ray. Hey, Dave. What's going on, you guys? It's been like, what, 50 episodes since you saw me last?
This will be 56th. You are the very first guest we had on Paleo Nerds, so it's an honor to have you back.
I got to say, I've been really loving Paleo Nerds, you guys. It's been I've listened to almost all of them, and it's been really fun to sort of watch you guys wander through the fields of fossils and meet all the amazing people that are out there doing cool things. It's been an amazing profession.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's really kind of you.
Yeah, thank you. It's been an eye-opener for me not being an academic.
Yeah, no, it's a different world, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, we have been having so much fun doing all this. And, you know, a lot of the connections that you and I made over the years, you know, and scientists, you know, as you said, that you're a scientist that collects artists, and I'm an artist that collects scientists. And Dave's a ventriloquist that apparently collects artists and scientists. So
and puppets.
And puppets, yeah, yeah. So he's a ventriloquist. That makes us... Yeah, his fans.
The dummies. But, there you go.
Oh, man.
So, hey, you know, we've been hanging out here a lot here in the last couple of years, you know, staying at home. And did you guys watch Prehistoric Planet?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And what's your take on it, man?
You know, Prehistoric Planet was pretty amazing. First of all, David Attenborough is 96 years old, which blows my mind. Now, all he had to do was, like, take three steps onto a green screen. So it wasn't like he was actually marching through the landscape, but the guy's picture perfect. And it's amazing. It's just lovely watching him wander into a Cretaceous meadow. And then it's like, there's Attenborough, that's a Cretaceous meadow. And you know, insane. That having been said, it's really interesting because I remember the very first BBC's Walking with Dinosaurs series. I don't know how long ago that was, but as a paleobotanist, these things really get my goat because they're reconstructing the late Cretaceous, which is a time that, you know, in many ways, the vegetation sort of looked like what it looks like right now. And we have a pretty good idea of late Cretaceous vegetation. But it allows BBC to basically take modern vegetation and put dinosaurs in it. It's the same thing they did at the original Jurassic Park. Amazing work with dinosaurs and pterosaurs and marine reptiles, incredible animation, great CGI, but they're filming them in modern landscapes, which...
I noticed that too. It's like, you know, wait, having hung out with you, I was critiquing the whole thing too, going, wait, they're just plunking. They shot this stuff in Hawaii or Madagascar or something.
Or Alaska.
And they're plunking dinosaurs into it.
Yeah.
Or Alaska. You know,
I thought the dinosaurs were amazing, though. I mean, they were absolutely so realistic. But the ecology around them left me with some major questions, like the sauropods in the desert around that water hole, and there's no greenery anywhere. And don't sauropods need tons of food per day to survive? Or was that a stretch or not, you think?
There is a profound bias that was present in Walking with Dinosaurs that's still there, which is that if you find a dinosaur fossil somewhere, you have an inherent accidental bias to reconstruct that ancient landscape as the same as it is today.
Right.
So you find a dinosaur in a desert, then you think, oh, these are desert dinosaurs. And if you find a dinosaur in northern Alaska, then there must have been snow. And to me, it's like basic 101. The world changes a lot, and we find dinosaurs in the desert because there's no plants covering the landscape now, and you can find dinosaurs because there's lots of rocks. You find dinosaurs in Alaska for the exact same reason. And then it drove me nuts, really, to see that one episode about dinosaurs in the snow and ice.
Yeah, I know. You know, you and I have been through this. We did our second book, you know, Cruising the Fossil Coastline. We went to Alaska. We dug up dinosaurs. And I so badly wanted to put that Pachyrhinosaurus and the Nanuxaurus in a snowy field because it would look so cool, but you didn't let me, man.
No, I know. You could have worked for BBC, Ray. They wouldn't let you do it.
But there's no proof. I mean, why would they? I saw the making of Prehistoric Planet, and they said if there was a questionable data, we didn't put it in. But having Pachyrhinosauruses in the snow is pretty questionable.
Yeah, no, I think that they just kind of missed the point about how animals live. Because they talk about how it was pitch black in the winter and it was cold, which it was, right? In the high Arctic, in the summers, you have summer 24 hours a day. In the winter, it's dark 24 hours a day. And most people assume that, well, therefore it must have been really cold. But the fossil record pretty much tells us that the polar regions were surprisingly warm in the winter, in the darkness. And we don't even know the chemistry of how that happens, but that's what we know. And then just sort of just see these amazing, jagged, modern British Columbia peaks covered in snow, and the dinosaurs marching around in the snow, and the Pachyrhinosaurus defending the Nunokosaurus in the snow. I'm like, come on, you know, just stop. Yeah. Just stop.
It makes for good drama, you know, but good background stuff.
But and science, the nerds are, science know. Is not supposed to be great drama. It's got to be factual-based drama.
But this is entertainment, man. You're watching it on your TV.
Well, go watch Jurassic World if you want entertainment.
Oh,
which,
Dominion.
Yeah, that was such a piece of fluff. I mean, there was some dinosaur candy in there, but it was so bad.
Yeah, I haven't watched the Dominion. But what I will say about the BBC thing is that what I did like about Prehistoric Planets was that it was very much like a David Attenborough does some modern place. Like, you know, he's known for his amazing photography of the Birds of Paradise, where he goes and watch these incredible things on planet Earth that most people have never seen because they've never been to where Birds of Paradise live. They've never caught them at the moment of the mating dance. And they did that.
Oh, you're right, it's here.
They did that. There we go, right. They did that with Prehistoric Planet. They speculated about things that might have happened that we have no way of knowing if they happened. And I kind of like that.
I love the creativity with it. You know, some of the creative department, some of the scenarios that start out with a swimming T-Rex. You know, I was like, all right, here's the logic behind that. It swam out to the island to have the babies or lead the babies out there. So I thought it was really creative. But you've actually had the opportunity to hang out with Sir David, right? And know, get to know him as a person. Is he like that? What's he like in person?
No, Sir David is amazing. He is kind and knowledgeable and interesting and interested. He loves fossils. He's like a kid around fossils. And you know, I think he's my hero. That guy's amazing. He's been doing TV for like 50 or 60 years. And for anybody who does TV, and I do a little bit of TV myself, the guy is so good at what he does that he makes it hard to compete in any possible way. And it's amazing to think of this guy's 96 years old and punching out. How many TV shows did he do this last month? He did like
three or four.
Yeah, many episodes of many things. And so he's a national treasure in the United Kingdom, and he's just an amazing, amazing person. He's one of those icons of our childhood that's still around. He's sort of like the Jacques Cousteau or Jane Goodall or E.O. Wilson, David Attenborough. I mean, these are the giants of our time that have helped us see the natural world and the planet we live in. And guy's amazing.
Well, Kirk, you're going to be on that short list if you aren't on it already.
When I'm 96.
Yeah, man. Well, when you're 96. Well, you know, one of the things, a couple of things I learned from you from all the years that we've been driving around with a couple of books we've done, and we're working on a redo right now.
Yeah, wait, tell me about that, you guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you guys did Fossil Freeway in what year?
2007.
And you lived together, but you traveled around, right?
Years before that,
yeah. And then, now why do the book again?
Well, you know, it's the American West, right? So amazing things are happening out there all the time. And we finished the road trip for Cruising the Fossil Freeway in 2005. Book came out in 2007. And then we kicked around for a while, so we got to do another trip. And so we did a series of trips that created the Cruising the Fossil Coastline, which came out in 2018.
Accidentally. There was no plan.
So it's getting close to 18 years since we finished driving around the American West. And 18 years is a long time when it comes to fossil discoveries, because so many people are looking for fossils and finding them. And new museums are being built. New dinosaurs are being discovered. New concepts are being turned out. So you could go, we went back and read the book, and it's like, wow, there's a lot of new stuff that we could put in this book and refresh the book.
Is it going to be like a second edition?
Truly. It's a second edition. Right. So we're going to completely revamp it because basically they're gone. People can't get them now. They're like secondhand. Right. It's like, we got to bring this out. It's a classic. But how do we update it?
Well, I sold mine on eBay for $2.99.
I would have given you $3 for it, man.
But one of the things that, you know, you taught me about the landscapes as I got to, you know, drive around with you, you know, and I was doing the art thing and you were doing the science thing, that fossils are the memory of the earth. I like that phrase. You use that phrase a lot. And the fossils are everywhere. And there's been all these major discoveries in the last 20 some years that we didn't include in the book. And so the other day I said, man, send me a list of the highlights. What are the big highlights in the last 20 years in the American West? And that's, what's the biggest, man, in the last 20 or so years that we didn't get in the book?
Well, you know, for me, it was a hands-down easy answer to that question, which is the big discovery made at Snowmass, Colorado, which we talked about last time I was with you guys in 2010, when we found this high-elevation ice age discovery that yielded 6,000 bones from more than 50 mastodons and 12 mammoths and a whole bunch of other cool ice age animals, that whole world. So that was an incredible one. But then there's one that was quite recent, which was the discovery in 2018 of human footprints with mammoths down in White Sands. No, the San Diego one was pretty cool,
too. Oh, the footprints, right. Yeah. Footprints across
in New Mexico. And then, of course, this discovery by Tom Demaray in San Diego of what looks like evidence for humans 130,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Which,
that's mind-blowing. So do you accept that idea? I mean, what do you think about that idea?
So, you know, I visited San Diego and looked at the specimens that Tom found at this site near San Diego of...
Well, just explain what that is for our listeners who don't know.
So basically, it's a deposit near San Diego that has broken up mastodon bones, including some tusks and teeth, and some round hammer stones that have percussion marks. So like it looked like somebody had taken rocks and smashed these mastodon bones. And the bone breakage looks like it's in fresh bone. It's called green breaks. And there are no other stone tools, but it looks really clear that somebody broke up a bunch of mastodon bones with a bunch of round rocks.
And is there any controversy about the dating of that?
Yeah, I mean, it is found on a terrace that is from the previous ice age interval, the Sangamo, which is like 130,000 years ago. And they did a couple of dating techniques that gave dates of around 130,000 years. Now, this is way older than anybody ever thought the humans were in North America. The sort of the accepted date was sort of zeroing in around 17,000 years ago, and here's a fossil that's 130,000, almost 10 times older.
And the 17,000, is that way down in Chile, or is that like New Mexico Clovis?
17,000 is sort of a combination of looking at genetic dates from human remains and also archaeological sites. The Clovis is about 13,000, but there are some sites in Idaho that are about 16,000. And of course, this new discovery from New Mexico, which is 21,000 to 23,000. So there's whole body of accepted knowledge that humans were here 17,000, the White Sands, New Mexico thing pushed it back to 23,000. And then there's this weird discovery from San Diego, which is way older.
Well, you know, what blows my mind about that 100,000 years, it could maybe technically not even be our species.
Yeah, it could have been Homo erectus, conceivably.
Yeah.
But it's not been widely accepted, and I think for good reason, because extraordinary statements demand extraordinary data, and I think the site is consistent with human origin, but it doesn't have enough. There's no human bones. There's no obvious stone tools. There's no Swiss Army knife, if you will. There's like no smoking gun that it was human. But when I look at those things, I'm like, this is plausible. In my mind, it's a plausible find.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, yeah. One of the things, too, I think is cool is that there's one of the mastodon bones is like vertical.
Yeah, tusk.
You know?
The tusk is driven vertically into the ground, yeah.
That doesn't happen naturally.
Yeah.
Now, I have a question just on the Snowmass site. You found a huge number of individuals, but was there any new paleontology learned from all that? Because, I mean, there's many, many Ice Age fossil sites, and this was prolific.
Yeah, there were no new species, no unknown species. I mean, it was a pretty There are two different faunas that we found. There was an older fauna that had American mastodons, giant bison latifrons, and Jefferson's ground sloths in it. And then we found a younger fauna that had mammoths and deer. There's two different time periods in this one location. And they're, you know, you usually don't find the mammoths and the mastodons together. And these were technically not together. It's the same place, but different times.
Right.
So it was a kind of a cool site because it's sort of two sites for the price of one. And each one of them was a really amazing site. So I was like, you know, this is could not be better.
Again, we were there in your office when you got the phone call.
Yeah.
Yep.
And on a subsequent visit, I have a photo of my son and I with the latifrons in the fossil prep
room. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, amazing discovery that one was. But, you know, so that was like a diversion into the Ice Age. But there have been a tremendous number of people looking for dinosaurs out west and finding endless new dinosaurs, it seems.
There's a whole area around the Grand Staircase, correct? That's fairly new to science. In the last 20 years, we didn't write about it much in our book.
That's right. We talked about the Parasaurolophus plays the blues because there's an amazing set of badlands near Escalante, Utah, which has produced a couple of Parasaurolophus dinosaurs. But it's really rugged country. And starting in about the mid-90s, people started to poke their way into these really remote badlands. And by the 2000s, University of Utah was helicoptering into these places you couldn't really hike into. Denver Museum started going there. The Raymond Alf Museum started going there. And people were finding a new Campanian dinosaur world. And the Campanian is the second to the last time period of the Cretaceous. It's the age of Dinosaur Provincial Park up in Alberta. It's a super rich dinosaur time. If you look at dinosaur diversity, it peaks in the Campanian. It was certain sites having 25, 30 dinosaur species in a single formation.
Oh, that's the peak of dinosaur diversity then?
Yeah.
The last one is the Maastrichtian is the last.
That's right. Age. And there's big debate about whether the Maastrichtian actually sees a decline in diversity or not.
Right.
And, you know, it's a little bit tricky to count dinosaurs, but no one would dispute that the Campanian is not the most diverse we've seen. I mean, like six or seven kinds of hadrosaurs, six or seven kinds of horned dinosaurs, and lots of tyrannosaurs and ankylosaurs and ornithomimids. And
virtually everything coming out of there is new to science,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's the kind of cool thing is like they're the same groups of dinosaurs are there that you see in Dinosaur Provincial Park and up in Montana in the Campanian and like the Two Medicine Formation and places where Jack Horner was finding dinosaur eggs. But here down in Utah is this whole new location and all the dinosaurs are slightly different. There's a slightly different horned dinosaurs and slightly different duckbill dinosaurs and slightly different armored dinosaurs and slightly different tyrannosaurs. So it's just another view.
Is this over in the Laramidia side of the continent?
Remember, Laramidia is the western half of North America during the Cretaceous when the Seaway was there. So this would be the eastern side of Laramidia and the western side of the Western Interior Seaway.
Okay. Right.
The Proto Rocky Mountains, which is the Laramide orogeny, is the western. I love to say that is the western side of the Western Interior Seaway.
That's right.
But the eastern side was all pretty much flat in the Proto Appalachia.
Yeah, and you know we don't have too many fossils from the eastern side, although people have been finding fossils over there as well.
Well, Georgia. Didn't we speak to Cam Muscoli, who found them in Georgia?
Absolutely. Yeah. There are fossils that are on the East Coast. And Ray and I have been talking for a while about should we do the East Coast book because
a lot of sliders from White Castle.
To be sure. Waffle House.
Yeah. When we look at it in terms of geologic time, it's like these 10-year swaths, and old Mr. Troll is not getting any younger.
I know. I've hired a four-wheel drive wheelchair for Ray, and we're going to take him out.
No, just pull him on a trailer.
It's a big sled. You just haul him along.
Yeah.
But there's plenty to do on the East Coast, man. I keep thinking about it because living in Washington, D.C. now, they're fossils.
Can I go back real quick?
All right.
You made me think of East Coast, then I thought of Kenneth Lacovara, then I thought of Dreadnoughtus. They showed in Prehistoric Planet these air sacs coming out of their neck. Is there any evidence for that, or is it just pure conjecture?
Pretty speculative, but of course, dinosaurs did have a different way of breathing than mammals do. I mean, dinosaurs had this air sac breathing mechanism. Right. So
the bones were hollow and had air sac throughout the...
So I think this is what they were kind of getting at. There might have been a superficial expression of that. There's no evidence for it at all. But got to give them points for guessing wildly.
Yeah, well, that looked like we were on an alien planet rather than the late Cretaceous.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they were having fun, the creative department, you know. But, hey. So what else has happened in the Fossil West, though? Well, just ticking through some of these things. There's been a lot of dinosaurs that have been bought and sold.
Tanis. What do you think of our episode with Tanis? Did we walk the fine line of... giving the guy enough credit, but not enough?
Well, no, I really was listening with great attention to your report on Tanis because, you know, Tanis was discovered by Steve Nicholas, who's a commercial paleontologist who found this site that had a lot of fossil fish, and he decided he didn't want to deal with the fish, and he turned the site over to Robert De Palma, who's been working on it ever since. And he's been making pretty amazing statements about what happened to Tanis, and releasing them to places like the New Yorker magazine or this podcast and various things. And then there's the Dinosaur Apocalypse, which also had David Attenborough on it PBS and BBC. And he did a recent presentation at NASA at Goddard. And he's still putting out a lot of statements that have yet to be backed up with the scientific papers. And even when he talked to you guys, he was saying, oh, you should never talk about stuff in the media until you publish it in a peer-reviewed journals, as he was talking about it, having not published it in a peer-reviewed journal. So interesting to watch. I mean, it's clearly a fascinating site. And I have been to the site. I did go to Tanis when I didn't know what it was. I knew that it was the site that had produced the fossil fish, but it's about 10 meters below the Cretaceous Paleogene boundary. So I assumed it was Cretaceous.
But if this site is one of the greatest paleontological finds of this century, I mean, there's so much excitement. I kind of can't blame him for him leaking some of this stuff, but you're right. The paper needs to come out first, then the claim. Or how does it work in paleontology? Well, the claim first, and then the paper comes out like the day after?
It's been an 8-year leak. Is the problem. It's been leaking slowly for a while. And I think there's some amazing fossils, no doubt about it. I mean, what he hints at in the TV show are dinosaur feathers, which, boy, it'd be great to see an actual photograph of that. They sort of show up a little bit in the TV show. He's mentioned them and like, it'd be nice.
I see that there's little glimpses, and then they cut away.
Yeah, so what's that all about, right? I mean, I don't understand. Like, this is 8 years. If this is, and no one has found in North America a validated dinosaur feather ever, right? So it would be a unique find in North America. And if he has one, we would love to see it. But right now,
well, he described it. He described it in detail to us a bit, and. I think he's a maverick. He doesn't play by the rules. But like Dave said, we're like kids in the can. We just got to see it. So it's got to be incredibly difficult to be sitting on this
and not want to tell everybody.
And not want to, I don't know. So I feel for him. And and I understand the scientific community pushing back. But it's interesting to watch it all play out.
Yeah, and I think the bottom line of Tanis, which I think is a key point, is that the asteroid impact did happen in a moment, and it looks like he was lucky enough to catch a fossil site that captured that moment. That's really cool.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the bottom line conclusion doesn't deviate from what we've been saying since the late 80s, which was, guess what? There was an asteroid impact that whacked the dinosaurs. And so
in a day.
Well, it had to be a day. It had to be a day, right? The thing came in like a boom. It was there. There had to be that moment. And I think the really interesting insight from Tanis is that there's this seismic wave that goes ahead of the ejecta. So you start shaking up the landscape first. You start churning it up. And remember, to become a fossil, you have to die and get buried. And if you do that simultaneously, say you're getting killed by the thing that's burying you, gives you a pretty good chance. And he just happened to be lucky enough to get a fossil site that was churned up in advance of the advancing ejecta and actually caught the moment and fossilized the moment. That's cool.
Now, one thing I could never get a direct answer on, and that is there any ejecta closer to the impact site, the Chicxulub crater, which is large amounts of boulders or huge chunks?
Oh, yeah.
Where is that?
There's a place in Belize where there's a limestone.
I'm going there, by the way, New Year's.
We should go, because there's a limestone quarry that has building-sized boulders that were thrown from the impact 300 miles.
Really?
I mean, these are things the size of buildings that were lobbed.
And are they, like, impacted into limestone or into the ocean floor?
Yeah, exactly. They're gigantic limestone chunks that are smashed all together, and they're giant boulders.
So if you were a mile away, you'd see them raining down and impacting like a science fiction film.
Yeah, like giant buildings flying through the air at you.
So they can actually figure out that these rocks came from elsewhere?
But is that it? Just in Belize? There's nothing in Texas or in Mexico or in the Caribbean?
Well, no, I mean, like, for instance, the KT Battery section in Haiti is much thicker than it is elsewhere. So, like, this is how they found out where the Chicxulub crater was in the first place, was they were noticing there were places where the ejecta layer was thicker in the vicinity of the Gulf of Mexico. Hildebrand, who was the graduate student who actually located the crater.
He looked at the cores, the petroleum company's cores, right?
So that's how he confirmed it. But he was looking in the Caribbean because you were seeing the ejecta was a little bit thicker. He sort of zeroed on the search. And the site had been found. The crater had been found by an oil and gas company geologist who worked for Pemex in Mexico. And in 1982, the guy went to a conference and said, "I think I found the crater." And everybody ignored him. And he took his toys and went home. And then 8 years later, a graduate student's like, "Oh, I relocated the crater that this guy, Glenn Penfield was his name, Glenn found it, that he, no one paid attention to him, so he went away." So the crater was known within 2 years of the original Alvarez paper, but not recognized formally for a decade.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Interesting. Wow. Hey, one of the big finds over the last 20 years, too, has been the dueling dinosaurs.
Oh, yeah. That's,
can you tell me about the dueling dinosaurs? You've actually got to look at it.
Yeah, and I went up and had a good look. They're amazing. It's there's been a rapidly growing commercial excavation of dinosaurs in the Western United States for the last 30 years. And we saw the beginning of it when we were driving around, right? But it's continued at pace now. And the United States is the only place in the world where there are lots of dinosaurs, and it is legal to sell them and sell them commercially. So you have all the other dinosaur-producing countries in the world, it is illegal to own and sell dinosaurs. But in the United States, if you find a dinosaur on private land, it's private property, and you can buy and sell it. So there's a thriving commercial market in dinosaurs in the United States, and lots of people are out there digging dinosaurs. People looking for gold nuggets, people looking for dinosaurs, same kind of thing.
So if I'm in England and I find a plesiosaur in my backyard, it's not mine to sell?
No, England has it.
It's property of the crown.
Well, this is it. Like in England, it's full of treasures, right? England's been overrun by the Vikings and by the Romans, et cetera. And so there's lots of ancient treasure in England. If you find that treasure, you have to report it. And you can get rewarded for finding it, but you don't.
Yeah.
It's not finders keepers.
They're finding Roman hoards almost every year now.
Yeah, there's some amazing. Uh-huh. That wonderful movie that came out last year about the archaeological discovery.
The Viking ship.
Yeah, was a great.
Yeah, you know what? Just to say, in the British Museum, my favorite room is the hoard room, which has all the hoards that they've discovered the last several hundred years. It's just phenomenal.
Yeah.
Next to the Elgin marbles, but let's not talk about that. But,
Elgin.
But, hey, Elgin, excuse me.
Elgin.
All right, Elgin, you got me, Dave.
I got you.
But hey, back to the dueling dinosaurs. What are they?
Yeah.
And they're private, and they got sold,
yeah,
right?
They got sold. There are two dinosaurs found together. It looks like it's Hell Creek Formation. There was a little bit of mystery when it was first found because a lot of times these things come onto the market and you don't know where they were found because the person brings the fossils onto the market. And this guy who calls himself the dinosaur cowboy, Clayton Phipps, found two complete dinosaurs in close association. One was a Triceratops and one was a young Tyrannosaurus Rex. And they were both...
Oh my God.
They're both more or less complete. I saw them both. They're giant boulders, and they basically are each one has a skeleton in it, and the rock is really soft. You could cut it with a knife. And the problem is, as they started digging these out, they realized that not only they have almost the entire skeleton, because you could see, like, there's the tip of the nose, and there's a tail, and there's a foot. You could see these were whole skeletons poking through the rock, but there was also skin on them.
Oh.
So the problem is, when you have dinosaur skin, is that it's basically an imprint in the mud. It's not the skin isn't there, it's just an imprint in the mud.
Right.
So your initial thought when you see a dinosaur in the rock is to dig the rock away and expose the dinosaur. But if you do that, you remove the skin. And so if you leave the skin in place, you don't get to see the bones. So the guy found these incredible dinosaurs, but he's kind of stuck because he had to leave them in these big rocks because it would be in the rocks really soft. So how do you preserve the skin?
With a CT scan is the only way.
Yeah, but the thing was like I don't know how big they were. These are big rocks, Dave. These are like rocks that weigh several thousand pounds. So you need a big CT scanner. But you're right. That's the thing to do is to scan the whole thing. Image the entire skeleton in the block.
3D print it.
And then decide, you could print the bones out if you want, but then you decide, how are you going to dig this thing out of the rock? And so it was, everybody recognized this is an amazing fossil. They call it a dueling dinosaur. It says here you have one theropod, the little T-Rex, and the Triceratops. And there's a famous pair of dinosaurs that was found in Mongolia in the 60s by the Polish expedition.
I saw those in New York. Yeah.
Whereas the Velociraptor. Right.
The fighting dinosaurs.
Yeah. So right. Dueling is, okay, right? But there was a Protoceratops and a Velociraptor.
Right.
And literally the arm of the Velociraptor is in the beak of the Protoceratops, and the claw of the Velociraptor is in the eye socket of the Protoceratops. So those guys were fighting. They were fighting. The ones from Montana, the quote-unquote dueling dinosaurs, are adjacent to each other. They're like 2 feet away from each other.
Oh.
So they could have simply died in the same stream on the same day in the same year and be buried.
Were they buried by a sand dune, or was it through
a stream bed? It was a stream bed
deposit.
Stream bed,
right.
And right. The Tyrannosaurus' face is broken. It's like its face is snapped to the right, the front of his snout. So you could say, he got kicked in the face by the Triceratops as they were both dying, and he broke the face. Or the river flood.
Or
he got hit tree by a tree branch and it broke his face. Who knows?
So it ended up in a museum, though, right?
Yeah, so it's in the North Carolina State Museum in Raleigh, North Carolina, under the able hands of Lindsay Zano, who is a great dinosaur paleontologist. She's been doing great work out in Utah. She was one of Scott Sampson's students, and I was visiting her recently. She has some amazing Oviraptor eggs from Utah, some of the best dinosaur eggs I've seen from Utah. Mm. So there's some really very exciting fossils that she was finding, and then she was able to convince the board of trustees at the museum that they should acquire this dueling dinosaurs, and they're presently building a new facility at the museum in Raleigh, which is going to open, I think, later this year or early next year, all based around the dueling dinosaurs.
And how much do they get for this prize?
I don't know the number. If you read in the papers, I think it's less than $10 million.
Right.
But
should have let me know. I would have bought it and stuck it in my shed.
Well, this is what's happening now, is that dinosaurs, all of a sudden, there's been a resurgence of high-priced dinosaurs. Recently, a Deinonychus, which is a small dinosaur. Stan, yeah.
Yeah.
Stan went for $31.8 million.
It looks like that's going to end up in a museum in Abu Dhabi.
Yeah.
So it did end up in a public collection, but far, far away. But I don't know. What are your thoughts on high bidding for dinosaurs?
Well, I think what it's done is it's kind of... It's legal, first of all, so I would say that. It's not illegal, but it has really kind of made the American West this free-for-all, like it has always been. First it was the gold rush, and then it was for the land, and now it's the dinosaurs. It's sort of a free-for-all for anybody to go out there and find stuff and sell it to the highest bidder. And
it's going to circumvent paleontology and science.
Well, pretty much. I mean, not to say, I don't really cast aspersions on the people that do this because it's legal and they can do it, but it makes it very difficult for us, like professional paleontologists, to access property anymore, because you used to be able to go and talk to a rancher and say, hey, can we go go on your property and find a fossil and take it to a museum. They're like, no problem at all. But now it's like, no, someone's paying me for the right to look for dinosaurs on my property, so you can't come on the property. And so a lot of people who have been collecting for museums for years now can't access property. And meanwhile, the property is being leased out to dinosaur collectors who are, in some cases, very talented and trained and experts and do a good job of collecting the fossil and the data and sell. They sell the fossil, they sell the data with the fossils to the museum. In other cases, they go and sell the bones on eBay and break the dinosaurs up. So it's like this, right. You know, there's some good actors and there's some less than good actors out there.
As you find in any part of any business.
It's just business, right? It's just business.
You work at the Smithsonian. You're the director of the Natural History.
Smithsonian?
Yeah. You mean
the Smithsonian?
Yes, but in 2009, the Paleontological Resources Protection Act was enacted. What did that change for everybody?
This act came out at the very beginning of Obama's first term, and it had languished during the prior administrations. And when the law was first conceived, it was a law that was conceived to protect vertebrate fossils. When the law came out, it applied to all fossils, which caught all of us by surprise because most of the people sort of perceived that invertebrate fossils and plant fossils didn't need special legal protection, but that vertebrate fossils did, like dinosaurs and rare vertebrate fossils did. But the law covered them all. And that's been an interesting thing because the federal government manages lots and lots of fossil-bearing land in the American West and elsewhere in the country. And there's only a few paleontologists working for the federal government. They work for the Bureau of Land Management, for the Forest Service, for the state, for the national parks. And they're suddenly challenged with managing all fossils on all federal land in the American nation. And so it's been a challenge. Forest Service published its rules first. BLM is still working on their rules.
So I can't collect brachiopods on BLM land without a permit, no?
So you, Dave Strassman, can because you're a citizen. But me, Kirk Johnson, as a museum professional, cannot do so without a permit. Because I'm a professional. So there's a subtle difference there. Now, you can sell the ones you find. You collect them for personal use.
Sure.
You wouldn't be able to get a permit to collect dinosaurs. I would. But it's a subtle distinction. There's sort of what they call recreational collecting that's walled off. It still allows some recreational collecting for invertebrates and plants. But what it's done is it's created some confusion because there are, for instance, a lot of really skilled amateur collectors who collect, say, trilobites or ammonites and donate them to museums who now are sort of at the edge of the law. Like maybe they might have to get a permit if they dig too big of a hole. You know, there's all this ambiguity that's brought together by this law, including plants and invertebrates with the vertebrate fossils. So it does add some protection to vertebrates on federal land, only federal land. Doesn't talk about state land or private land, and it makes it more complicated for invertebrate paleontologists and paleobotanists. So it's been a controversial rule. You know, there has not been a commensurate increase in funding for federal fossil regulators to get out there and really do the right job of educating people about fossils and making permitting quick and easy. So it's been challenging.
Yeah, it's a little mind-blowing, isn't it? I guess maybe Dave and I doing paleo nerds for all this professionally, maybe we have to get permits now, Dave. I don't know. Are we professionals?
I'm sure with the amount of interviews we've done, we can probably... I know a few people who know a few people.
I think
we were invited to camp out in some very private places in Dinosaur National Monument by Rebecca, if you remember.
You wanted to go and
see some really awesome trackways deep away from the public. So I haven't taken her up on that, but that's some of the fantastic opportunities that we've been availed.
And we also talked to Scott Foss, who's with the Park Service too, kind of dialing rules in.
Well, he's the Park Service paleontologist.
He's the BLM paleontologist.
Oh, BLM guy. Yeah,
that's right.
See, now
my mistake. My mistake.
Yeah. Now, I was just at Dinosaur National Monument a couple of weeks ago, where they have rebuilt the building overlying the famous Earl Douglas Quarry. Because when Ray and I were there in 2005, the building had been condemned because they built the building on top of the quarry spoils. And the building was literally like breaking in half because the support beams were built on the old tailings of the quarry. They closed the building in 2009 and reopened the new building in 2011, October 2011. So I was just there for the first time since Ray and I had been there a long time ago.
Yeah.
And beautiful new structure. The wall of dinosaurs is insanely cool. And the really nice little museum there in downtown Vernal is great as well. So it's well worth a drive to the northwestern corner of Colorado, that remote part of Utah where Dinosaur National Monument is, because it's a great new museum and the Dinosaur National Monument is there for viewing.
On my bucket list.
You haven't been there?
Nope.
It'll blow your mind, man. I know.
There's so many things.
This is the place, though. This is like the pilgrimage site for all dinosaur lovers.
It is.
Well, I'm going on my first dig, actually.
Yeah, really? Actually, he's excited. He's going out to. Well, tell him, Dave.
I'm going out with John Scanella and Lee Hall out to eastern Montana.
Nice. Excellent.
Where there is a juvenile T-Rex, a Triceratops frill, and, as I said to Ray, a turtle the size of a tire. So
this is the Museum of the Rockies, guys, in Bozeman,
yeah.
Right? This is the legacy of Jack Horner and his museum.
Yeah.
And these are, Scanella is a former Jack Horner student, and Lee Hall.
So my son and I, Carson and I, are going out. It'll be a great week.
You remember, Ray, that Lee Hall is married to Ashley, who you guys interviewed on your show. So it's all the big fossil family.
Right, and on their honeymoon, they followed our book, Cruising the Fossil Freeway. Yeah, see how it all ties back in.
I thought that was going to start a huge trend. That was going to be a huge trend, and it never came through. The big,
it did for one couple.
Yeah, we'll call victory.
I was reading back through the book, and I don't claim that we actually came up with the term Paleo Nerds, but maybe I could.
No, we did.
You did.
It was our turn.
When we started this podcast.
But we have written proof here, and I quote from page 49, where you say, "I began to realize that wherever we went, we bumped into people just like ourselves, paleo nerds." So there
it is.
It was
there
born.
Well, know what? I think we should give him 10% of all the income we've made off of paleo nerds.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah,
that's a great idea. We are rolling in it.
Yeah, you're going to owe us, actually, because there's been zero. We do this for free.
I'll take my wheelbarrow of cash to the bank.
Looking back 20 years, so this has been great. I've known you for 28 years, Kirk. And, we became friends. We drove around. And actually, at one time, we calculated that we were maybe in it spent almost a year together, solidly, which is a lot of time. By the way, did you know you actually spend 26 years of your life asleep? It's kind of a weird thing. I was just like looking up the other day, but
yeah. And guess what? I avoid your snoring during those.
Well, I have a CPAP now, so I'm cured. So you can sleep near me now.
Really? Wait, stop.
Yeah.
What? You're cured?
I have a CPAP.
What's that mean?
What's continuous? Well, actually, Kirk,
it's a machine, right? Is that a machine?
It's a breathing machine that stuffs air down your throat that keeps you from snoring. It's a handy device.
So you're going to take that in the tent with you when we go fossiling in Alaska?
He plugs it right into the outcrop, and it gets the fossil fuel.
Uses
the fossil fuel energy.
Okay, great.
Keeps it from snoring.
What I was leading up to in my preamble there was that, we spent all this time, we've seen this resurgence or really kind of a dinosaur renaissance and paleo love. We helped foster paleo love. But really, we began to see that paleontology, I began to realize that how relevant it was, and I know that one of the things that you've done since the Smithsonian and since all the controversy around climate change is that one of the things you actually tasked your scientists with was actually, hey, well, let's see what the temperature has been and what the climate has been, not only for the last few, million years, but since it's in the fossil record. We go back to the Cambrian and maybe even before. And what were the results of that? What's the long view of climate and the planet and where we're at now?
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing. And when I started doing paleontology back in the 80s, we were aware that you could use fossils to reconstruct ancient climates. And then we used fossil leaves, for instance. There is a famous thing where you could actually measure the percentage of species of fossil leaves that had smooth margins And that percentage would correlate with the actual mean annual temperature of the climate in which those trees were growing. It works in modern forests, for instance. You can go to a modern forest and grab a bag of leaves. You can sort the leaves into different species, measure the percentage that have smooth margins, and actually tell.
What do you mean by smooth margins? You mean the edges?
Yeah, some leaves have teeth on them and some have smooth edges.
Right.
And so it's the percentage of smooth margined leaves is correlated with temperature. So if you go to a tropical rainforest, for instance, about 90% of the leaves are smooth margins, about 10% have teeth. So it's called leaf margin analysis. And for the longest time, it was been one of the exports of paleobotany to the world of science, was we could tell you what the temperature was. And so we were aware of this, but it wasn't until the late 80s, early 90s, when people started worrying a lot about climate, and suddenly paleobotanists, who had considered themselves to be largely irrelevant to modern issues, suddenly like, whoa, we can tell you what the temperature was 64 million years ago. So we started exporting these temperatures, and this is what we call a climate proxy. The leaf fossils are telling you what an ancient climate was. So
wait, how do you do this in a conifer forest where all you have are needles?
You don't.
Okay.
You need a broad-leafed forest where there's lots of broadleaves. Right. And this was done, and there's a famous geologist named Jack Wolf from the U.S. Geological Survey who studied modern forests around the world and plotted the relative abundance of smooth versus toothed leaves and produced these global curves. And then everybody started using it for the fossils, and all of a sudden paleobotanists could tell you climate at a given time, but they could also show you climate over time. And that was part of how we started to understand that there used to be warmer periods in the past. And once people started getting worried about the fact that the climate was warming, then the paleobotanists were able to say, hey, wait a minute, I can tell you what the world will look like when it warms to a certain temperature, because I have fossils that lived in a warmer Earth. So looking into the past is the same thing as looking into the future. And suddenly we are, as paleobotany in general, I think we're all like, oh my goodness, we're actually relevant. Because no one actually thought that paleobotanists were relevant to anything. But suddenly it's like, wow, you guys matter. And I was like, that was pretty cool. So that was one of the things that actually got me into the whole climate conversation, was that I knew about ancient climates because I was a paleobotanist. And when we were building the Deep Time exhibit that opened in June of 2019 in Washington, D.C., I challenged Scott Wing and Brian Huber, who are two of the paleontologists, who are both excellent paleoclimatologists. Scott uses fossil leaves, and Brian uses marine forams to get climate temperature. I said, look, you guys, paleontologists all know that there's a climate record for the last half a billion years, the entire Phanerozoic, from the Cambrian to the present. But it's hard to make a single curve because at different time periods, you use different climate proxies to get your estimates. Right. Some places it's forams, some places it's leaves, sometimes it's clams, all this kind of stuff. And I said to them, I said, is it possible for you guys to pull together a group of people that span the entire time period, the last 500 million years, and look at all those climate proxies and get in the room and argue yourself to a climate curve for the last 500 million years that you would all agree on? Wow. And they did it. They actually did it.
Really?
And it's an amazing thing because, you know, it was about 40 of them, and they worked on it. And then they launched a project, which is called the Fantastic Project, which is, I don't remember exactly what the acronym stands for. It's basically a Phanerozoic climate curve. And there's a postdoc student named Emily Judd, who should probably interview on this on PaleoNerds,
write it down,
who has created this 500 million year climate curve for the planet. And it's a live thing, so the new data can be pumped into it and tweak the curve. But one of the take home messages is that for about 75% of the last 500 million years, the planet has not had polar ice caps.
Wow.
So the condition where we have today, where we have polar ice caps, that's in the minority. That's 25% of Earth history. And it's a common thing on the planet for when you have polar ice caps, the climate to change and the polar ice caps to melt away. So where we're going in the future is where we've been for three quarters of the past, if you want to think about it that way.
Right. So, I mean, you could think of it as, well, we're just going back to normal.
You could think that, and in a way, that is true, which is kind of a wonderful thing.
Yeah, but there's proof that we're pumping carbon dioxide into our atmosphere.
Well, Dave, this is the whole point, is that humans are doing geology right now, and in the past, we've gone from cold to warm and from warm to cold. When we went from cold to warm, it was because carbon dioxide was being pumped into the atmosphere by volcanoes. Now it's just people. So when people say
7 point something billion of us.
Oh, way more than that, my friend. We're about to crest 8 billion, and probably January or February of 2023 we'll crest 8 billion.
Well, I did say 7 point something.
There you go.
But let me ask you this. What is the main driver through time for that climate variation? Does it just come down to pretty much volcanoes?
It's carbon dioxide.
What they spew out?
It's carbon dioxide. It's the